The spare t-shirt and sweatshirt she had packed, Gayton Boosters Club printed across the front, went flying. Batteries rolled. Her spare flashlight hit the tile floor, and the lens cover cracked. That was enough to convince Clay. This wasn't a Sharon Riddell tantrum because they were out of hazelnut coffee or chunky monkey ice cream. This was unvarnished terror. He went to Alice, knelt beside her, and took hold of her wrists. He could feel the seconds flying by, turning into minutes they should have been using to put this town behind them, but he could also feel the lightning sprint of her pulse under his fingers. And he could see her eyes. It wasn't panic in them now, but agony, and he realized she'd put everything in that sneaker. Her mother and father, her friends, Beth Nickerson and her daughter, the Tunney Field Inferno, everything. "It's not in here," she cried. "I thought I must have packed it, but I didn't. I can't find it anywhere." "No, honey, I know." Clay was still holding her wrists. Now he lifted the one with the shoelace around it. "Do you see?" He waited until he was sure her eyes had focused. Then he flipped the ends beyond the knot, where there had been a second knot. "It's too long now," she said. "It wasn't that long before." Clay tried to remember the last time he'd seen the sneaker. He told himself it was impossible to remember a thing like that, given all that had been going on. Then realized he could. Very clearly, too. It was when she'd helped Tom pull him up after the second truck had exploded. It had been dancing from its string then. She had been covered with blood, scraps of cloth, and little chunks of flesh, but the sneaker had still been on her wrist. He tried to remember if it was still there when she'd booted the burning torso off the ramp. He didn't think so. Maybe that was hindsight, but he didn't think so. "It came untied, honey," he said. "It came untied and fell off."
"I lost it?"
Her eyes unbelieving. The first tears.
"Are you sure?"
"Pretty sure, yeah."
"It was my luck,"
she whispered, the tears spilling over. "No," Tom said, and put an arm around her. "We're your luck." She looked at him.
"How do you know?"
"Because you found us first," Tom said. "And we're still here." She hugged them both, and they stood that way for a while, the three of them, with their arms around each other in the hall, with Alice's few possessions scattered around their feet. Chapter 25. The fire spread to a lecture building the head identified as Hackery Hall. Then, around 4 a.m., the wind dropped away, and it spread no farther. When the sun came up, the Gayton campus stank of propane, charred wood, and a great many burnt bodies. The bright sky of a perfect New England morning in October was obscured by a rising column of gray-black smoke, and Cheatham Lodge was still occupied. In the end, it had been like dominoes. The head couldn't travel except by car. Car travel was impossible, and Jordan would not go without the head. Nor was Ardai able to persuade him. Alice, although resigned to the loss of her talisman, refused to go without Jordan. Tom would not go without Alice. And Clay was loath to go without the two of them, although he was horrified to find these newcomers in his life seemed at least temporarily more important than his own son, and although he continued to feel certain that they would pay a high price for what they'd done on Tunney Field if they stayed in Gayton, let alone at the scene of the crime. He thought he might feel better about that last at daybreak, but he did not. The five of them watched and waited at the living room window, but of course nothing came out of the smoldering wreckage, and there was no sound but the low crackle of fire eating deep into the athletic department offices and locker rooms, even as it finished off the bleachers above ground. The thousand or so phone crazies who had been roosting there were, as Alice had said, crispy. The smell of them was rich and stick-in-your-throat awful. Clay had vomited once and knew the others had as well, even the head. "We made a mistake," he thought again.
"You guys should have gone on," Jordan said. "We would have been all right. We were before, weren't we, sir?"
Headmaster Ardai ignored the question. He was studying Clay.
"What happened yesterday when you and Tom were in that service station? I think something happened then to make you look as you do now."
"Oh? How do I look, sir?"
"Like an animal that smells a trap."
"Did
Did those two in the street see you?
It wasn't exactly that, Clay said. He didn't love being called an animal, but couldn't deny that was what he was. Oxygen and food in, carbon dioxide and shit out. Pop goes the weasel. The head had begun to rub restlessly at the left side of his midsection with one big hand. Like many of his gestures, Clay thought it had an oddly theatrical quality. Not exactly phony, but meant to be seen at the back of the lecture hall.
Then what exactly was it?
And because protecting the others no longer seemed like an option, Clay told the head exactly what they'd seen in the office of the Sitgo station. A physical struggle over a box of stale treats that had suddenly turned into something else. He told about the fluttering papers, the ashes that had begun circling in the ashtray like water going down a bathtub drain, the keys jingling on the board, the nozzle that fell off the gas pump.
I saw that, Jordan said,
and Alice nodded. Tom mentioned feeling short of breath, and Clay agreed. They both tried to explain the sense of something powerful building in the air. Clay said it was how things felt before a thunderstorm. Tom said the air just felt fraught somehow, too heavy.
Then he let her take a couple of the fucking things and it all went away, Tom said. The ashes stopped spinning, the keys stopped jingling, that thundery feeling went out of the air.
He looked to Clay for confirmation. Clay nodded. Alice said,
Why didn't you tell us this before?
Because it wouldn't have changed anything, Clay said. We were going to burn the nest if we could, regardless.
Yes, Tom said.
Jordan said suddenly,
You think the phone crazies are turning into psionics, don't you?
Tom said, I don't know what that word means, Jordan.
People who can move things around just by thinking about it, for one thing. Or by accident, if their emotions get out of control. Only psionic abilities like telekinesis and levitation.
Levitation, Alice almost barked.
Jordan paid no mind.
Are only branches. The trunk of the psionic tree is telepathy, and that's what you're afraid of, isn't it? The telepathy thing.
Tom's fingers went to the place above his mouth where half of his mustache was gone and touched the reddened skin there.
Well, the thought has crossed my mind.
He paused, head cocked.
That might be witty. I'm not sure.
Jordan ignored this as well.
Say that they are. Getting to be true telepaths, I mean, and not just zombies with a flocking instinct. So what? The Gaten Academy flock is dead, and they died without a clue of who lit them up, because they died in whatever passes for sleep with them. So if you're worrying that they telepathically faxed our names and descriptions to any of their buddies in the surrounding New England states, you can relax.
Jordan,
the head began, then winced. He was still rubbing his midsection.
Sir, are you all right?
Yes. Fetch my Zantac from the downstairs bathroom, would you? And a bottle of the Poland spring water. There's a good lad.
Jordan hurried away on the errand. Not an ulcer, is it? Tom asked.
No, the head replied. It's stress. An old, one cannot say, friend, acquaintance. Your heart okay?
Alice asked, speaking in a low voice.
I suppose,
the head agreed and bared his teeth in a smile of disconcerting jollity.
If the Zantac doesn't work, we may resuppose. But so far the Zantac always has, and one doesn't care to buy trouble when so much of it is on sale. Ah, Jordan, thank you.
Quite welcome, sir.
The boy handed him the glass and the pill with his usual smile.
I think you ought to go with them,
Ardai told him after swallowing the Zantac.
Sir, with all respect, I'm telling you there's no way they could know. No way!
The head looked a question at Tom and Clay. Tom raised his hands. Clay only shrugged. He could say what he felt right out loud, could articulate what they surely must know he felt. We made a mistake, and staying here is compounding it, but saw no point. Jordan's face was set and stubborn on top, scared to death just beneath. They were not going to persuade him. And besides, it was day again. Day was their time. He rumpled the boy's hair.
If you say so, Jordan, I'm going to catch some winks.
Jordan looked almost sublimely relieved.
That sounds like a good idea. I think I will, too.
I'm going to have a cup of Cheatham Lodge's world-famous tepid cocoa before I come up, Tom said. And I believe I'll shave off the rest of this mustache.
The wailing and lamentation you hear will be mine.
Can I watch? Alice asked. I always wanted to watch a grown man wail and lament.
Chapter 26 Clay and Tom were sharing a small bedroom on the third floor. Alice had been given the only other. While Clay was taking off his shoes, there was a perfunctory knock on the door which the head followed without pause. Two bright spots of color burned high up on his cheekbones. Otherwise, his face was deathly pale.
"Are you all right?" Clay asked, standing. "Is it your heart, after all?"
"I'm glad you asked me that," the head replied. "I wasn't entirely sure I planted the seed, but it seems I did."
He glanced back over his shoulder into the hall, then closed the door with the tip of his cane.
"Listen carefully, Mr. Riddell, Clay, and don't ask questions unless you feel you absolutely must. I am going to be found dead in my bed late this afternoon or early this evening, and you will say, of course, it was my heart, after all, that what we did last night must have brought it on. Do you understand?"
Clay nodded. He understood, and he bit back the automatic protest. It might have had a place in the old world, but it had none here. He knew why the head was proposing what he was proposing.
"If Jordan even suspects I may have taken my own life to free him from what he, in his boyishly admirable way, regards as a sacred obligation, he may take his own. At the very least, he would be plunged into what the elders of my own childhood called a black fugue. He will grieve for me deeply as it is, but that is permissible. The thought that I committed suicide to get him out of Gayton is not. Do you understand that?"
"Yes," Clay said. Then, "Sir, wait another day. What you're thinking of, it may not be necessary. Could be we're going to get away with this." He didn't believe it, and in any case, Ardai meant to do what he said. All the truth Clay needed was in the man's haggard face, tightly pressed lips and gleaming eyes. Still, he tried again. "Wait another day. No one may come."
"You heard those screams," the head replied. "That was rage. They'll come."
"Maybe, but—" The head raised his cane to forestall him.
"And if they do, and if they can read our minds as well as each other's, what will they read in yours if yours is still here to be read?"
Clay didn't reply, only watched the head's face.
"Even if they can't read minds," the head continued, "what do you propose? To stay here, day after day and week after week, until the snow flies? Until I finally expire of old age? My own father lived to the age of 97. Meanwhile, you have a wife and a child."
"My wife and boy are either all right or they're not. I've made my peace with that." This was a lie, and perhaps Ardai saw it in Clay's face, because he smiled his unsettling smile.
"And do you believe your son has made peace with not knowing if his father is alive, dead, or insane? After only a week?"
"That's a low blow," Clay said. His voice was not quite steady.
"Really? I didn't know we were fighting. In any case, there's no referee. No one here but us chickens, as they say."
The head glanced at the closed door, then looked back at Clay again.
"The equation is very simple. You can't stay, and I can't go. It's best that Jordan go with you."
"But to put you down like a horse with a broken leg—"
"No such thing," the head interrupted. "Horses do not practice euthanasia, but people do."
The door opened, Tom stepped in, and with hardly a pause for breath, the head went on.
"And have you ever considered commercial illustration, Clay? For books, I mean."
My style is too flamboyant for most of the commercial houses," Clay said. "I have done jackets for some of the small fantasy presses like Grant and Eulalia. Some of the Edgar Rice Burroughs Mars books."
"Barsoom!"
the head cried, and waved his cane vigorously in the air. Then he rubbed his solar plexus and grimaced.
"Damned heartburn. Excuse me, Tom. Just came up to have a natter before lying down a bit myself."
"Not at all," Tom said, and watched him go out. When the sound of the head's cane had gotten a good distance down the hall, he turned to Clay and said,
"Is he okay? He's very pale."
"I think he's fine." He pointed at Tom's face. "I thought you were going to shave off the other half."
I decided against it with Alice hanging around, Tom said. I like her, but about certain things, she can be evil.
That's just paranoia.
Thanks, Clay, I needed that. It's only been a week and I'm already missing my analyst.
Combined with a persecution complex and delusions of grandeur.
Clay swung his feet up onto one of the room's two narrow beds, put his hands behind his head, and looked at the ceiling.
You wish we were out of here, don't you? Tom asked.
You bet I do. He spoke in a flat and uninflected monotone.
It'll be all right, Clay, really.
So you say. But you have a persecution complex and delusions of grandeur.
That's true, Tom said. But they're balanced out by poor self-image and ego menstruation at roughly 6-week intervals. And in any case,
too late now, at least for today, Clay finished.
That's right.
There was actually a kind of peace in that. Tom said something else, but Clay only caught. Jordan thinks...
And then he was asleep.
Chapter 27. He woke screaming, or so he thought at first. Only a wild look at the other bed, where Tom was still sleeping peacefully with something, a washcloth maybe, folded over his eyes, convinced Clay that the scream had been inside his head. A cry of some sort might have escaped him, but if so, it hadn't been enough to wake his roommate. The room was nowhere near dark. It was mid-afternoon, but Tom had pulled the shade before corking off himself, and it was at least dim. Clay stayed where he was for a moment, lying on his back, his mouth as dry as wood shavings, his heartbeat rapid in his chest and in his ears, where it sounded like running footsteps muffled in velvet. Otherwise, the house was dead still. They might not have made the switch over from days to nights completely yet, but last night had been extraordinarily exhausting, and at this moment he heard no one stirring in the lodge. Outside a bird called, and somewhere quite distant, not in Gayton, he thought, a stubborn alarm kept on braying. Had he ever had a worse dream? Maybe one. A month or so after Johnny was born, Clay had dreamed he'd picked the baby up from the crib to change him, and Johnny's chubby little body had simply fallen apart in his hands, like a badly put-together dummy. That one he could understand. Fear of fatherhood, fear of fucking up. A fear he still lived with, as Headmaster Ardai had seen. What was he to make of this one? Whatever it meant, he didn't want to lose it. And he knew from experience that you had to act quickly to keep that from happening. There was a desk in the room, and a ballpoint pen tucked into one pocket of the jeans Clay had left crumpled at the foot of the bed. He took the pen, crossed to the desk in his bare feet, sat down, and opened the drawer above the knee hole. He found what he was hoping for, a little pile of blank stationery with the heading Gayton Academy and A Young Mind is a Lamp in the Darkness on each sheet. He took one of them and placed it on the desk. The light was dim but would serve. He clicked out the tip of the ballpoint and paused for just a moment, recalling the dream as clearly as he could. He, Tom, Alice, and Jordan had been lined up in the center of a playing field, not a soccer field like Tunney, a football field maybe. There had been some sort of skeletal construction in the background with a blinking red light on it. He had no idea what it was, but he knew the field had been full of people looking at them. People with ruined faces and ripped clothes that he recognized all too well. He and his friends had been... Had they been in cages? No, on platforms. And they were cages all the same, although there were no bars. Clay didn't know how that could be, but it was. He was losing the details of the dream already. Tom was on one end of the line. A man had walked to him, a special man, and put a hand over his head. Clay didn't remember how the man could do that since Tom, like Alice, Jordan, and Clay himself, had been on a platform, but he had. And he'd said, Ecce homo insanus. And the crowd, thousands of them, had roared back, Don't touch! In a single voice. The man had gone to Clay and repeated this. With his hand above Alice's head, the man had said,
Ecce femina insana.
Above Jordan,
Ecce puer insanus.
Each time the response had been the same. Don't touch! Neither the man, the host, the ringmaster, or the people in the crowd had opened their mouths during this ritual. The call and response had been purely telepathic. Then, letting his right hand do all the thinking, his hand and the special corner of his brain that ran it, Clay began to stroke an image onto the paper. The entire dream had been terrible, the false accusation of it, the cautness of it. But nothing in it had been so awful as the man who had gone to each of them, placing his open, palm-down hand over their heads like an auctioneer preparing to sell livestock at a county fair. Clay felt that if he could catch that man's image on paper, he could catch the terror. He had been a black man with a noble head and an ascetic's face above a lanky, almost scrawny body. The hair was a tight cap of dark ringlets, cut open on one side by an ugly triangular gouge. The shoulders were slight, the hips nearly non-existent. Below the cap of curls, Clay quick-sketched the broad and handsome forehead, a scholar's forehead. Then he marred it with another slash and shaded in the hanging flap of skin that obscured one eyebrow. The man's left cheek had been torn open, possibly by a bite, and the lower lip was also torn on that side, making it droop in a tired sneer. The eyes were a problem. Clay couldn't get them right. In the dream, they had been both full of awareness, yet somehow dead. After two tries, he left them and dropped to the pullover before he lost that. The kind the kids called a hoodie, red, he printed with an arrow, with white block letters across the front. It had been too big for the skinny body, and a flap of material lay over the top half of the letters, but Clay was pretty sure it said, Harvard. He was starting to print that when the weeping started, soft and muffled, from somewhere below him. Chapter 28. It was Jordan, Clay knew at once. He took one look back over his shoulder at Tom as he pulled on his jeans, but Tom hadn't moved. Out for the count, Clay thought. He opened the door, slipped through, and closed it behind him. Alice, wearing a Gayton Academy t-shirt as a nightgown, was sitting on the second-floor landing with the boy cradled in her arms. Jordan's face was pressed against her shoulder. She looked up at the sound of Clay's bare feet on the stairs and spoke before Clay said something he might have regretted later. Is it the head?
He had a bad dream, she said.
Clay said the first thing that came to him. At that moment, it seemed vitally important.
Did you?
Her brow creased, bare-legged with her hair pulled back in a ponytail and her face sunburned as if from a day at the beach, she looked like Jordan's 11-year-old sister.
What? No, I heard him crying in the hall. I guess I was waking up anyway, and...
Just a minute, Clay said. Stay right there. He went back to his third-floor room and snatched his sketch off the desk. This time, Tom's eyes sprang open. He looked around with a mixture of fright and disorientation, then fixed on Clay and relaxed.
Back to reality, he said,
then rubbing a hand over his face and getting up on one elbow.
Thank God. Jesus.
What time is it? Tom, did you have a dream? A bad dream? Tom nodded.
I think so, yeah. I heard crying.
Was that Jordan?
Yes. What did you dream? Do you remember? Somebody called us insane, Tom said, and Clay felt his stomach drop. Which we probably are. The rest is gone. Why? Did you...
Clay didn't wait for any more. He hurried back out and down the stairs again. Jordan looked around at him with a kind of dazed timidity when Clay sat down. There was no sign of the computer whiz now. If Alice looked 11 with her ponytail and sunburn, Jordan had regressed to 9. Jordan, Clay said, your dream, your nightmare, do you remember it?
It's going away now, Jordan said. They had us up on stands. They were looking at us like we were, I don't know, wild animals. Only they said
that we were insane. Jordan's eyes widened.
Yeah.
Clay heard footfalls behind him as Tom came down the stairs. Clay didn't look around. He showed Jordan his sketch.
Was this the man in charge?
Jordan didn't answer. He didn't have to. He winced away from the picture, grabbing for Alice and turning his face against her chest again.
What is it?
Alice asked, bewildered. She reached for the sketch, but Tom took it first.
Christ, he said, and handed it back. The dream's almost gone, but I remember the torn cheek.
And his lip,
Jordan said, the words muffled against Alice's chest.
The way his lip hangs down. He was the one showing us to them. To them.
He shuddered. Alice rubbed his back, then crossed her hands over his shoulder blades so she could hold him more tightly. Clay put the picture in front of Alice. Ring any bells? Man of your dreams? She shook her head and started to say no. Before she could, there was a loud, protracted rattling and a loose series of thuds from outside Cheatham Lodge's front door. Alice screamed. Jordan clutched her tighter, as if he would burrow into her, and cried out. Tom clutched at Clay's shoulder.
Oh man, what the fuck?
There was more rattling thunder outside the door, long and loud. Alice screamed again.
Guns, Clay shouted. Guns!
For a moment they were all paralyzed there on the sunny landing, and then another of those long, loud rattles came, a sound like rolling bones. Tom bolted for the third floor and Clay followed him, skidding once in his stocking feet and grabbing the banister to regain his balance. Alice pushed Jordan away from her and ran for her own room, the hem of the shirt fluttering around her legs, leaving Jordan to huddle against the newel post, staring down the stairs and into the front hall with huge wet eyes. Chapter 29
Easy, Clay said. Let's just take this easy, okay?
The three of them stood at the foot of the stairs not 2 minutes after the first of those long, loose rattling sounds had come from beyond the front door. Tom had the unproven Russian assault rifle they had taken to calling Sir Speedy. Alice was holding a 9mm automatic in each hand, and Clay had Beth Nickerson's .45, which he had somehow managed to hold on to the previous night, although he had no memory of tucking it back into his belt, where he later found it. Jordan still huddled on the landing. Up there he couldn't see the downstairs windows, and Clay thought that was probably a good thing. The afternoon light in Cheatham Lodge was much dimmer than it should have been, and that was most definitely not a good thing. It was dimmer because there were phone crazies at every window they could see, crowded up to the glass and peering in at them. Dozens, maybe hundreds of those strange blank faces, most marked by the battles they had been through and the wounds they had suffered during the last anarchic week. Clay saw missing eyes and teeth, torn ears, bruises, burns, scorched skin, and hanging wads of blackened flesh. They were silent. There was a kind of haunted avidity about them, and that feeling was back in the air, that breathless sense of some enormous, spinning power barely held in check. Clay kept expecting to see their guns fly out of their hands and begin to fire on their own. At us, he thought.
Now I know how the lobsters feel in the tank at Harbor Seafood on Two for Tuesday, Tom said in a small, tight voice.
Just take it easy,
Clay repeated.
Let them make the first move.
But there was no first move. There was another of those long, rattling thumps. The sound of something being offloaded on the front porch was what it sounded like to Clay. And then the creatures at the windows drew back, as if at some signal only they could hear. They did this in orderly rows. This wasn't the time of day during which they ordinarily flocked, but things had changed. That seemed obvious. Clay walked to the bay window in the living room, holding the revolver at his side. Tom and Alice followed. They watched the phone crazies, who no longer seemed crazy at all to Clay, at least not in any way he understood, retreat, walking backward with eerie, limber ease, each never losing the little envelope of space around him or herself. They settled to a stop between Cheatham Lodge and the smoking remains of the Tunney soccer stadium, like some raggedy-ass army battalion on a leaf-strewn parade ground. Every not-quite-vacant eye rested upon the headmaster's residence.
"Why are their hands and feet all smudgy?"
a timid voice asked. They looked around. It was Jordan. Clay himself hadn't even noticed the soot and char on the hands of the silent hundreds out there. But before he could say so, Jordan answered his own question.
"They went to see, didn't they?"
"Sure.
They went to see what we did to their friends. And they're mad. I can feel it. Can you feel it?"
Clay didn't want to say yes, but of course he could. that heavy, charged feeling in the air, that sense of turning thunder, barely contained in a net of electricity. That was rage. He thought about Pixie Light battening on Power Suit Woman's neck, and the elderly lady who'd won the Battle of the Boylston Street Tea Station, the one who'd gone striding off into Boston Common with blood dripping out of her cropped iron-gray hair. The young man, naked except for his sneakers, who had been jabbing a car aerial in each hand as he ran. All that rage. Did he think it had just disappeared when they started to flock? Well, think again. I feel it, Tom said. Jordan, if they've got psychic powers, why don't they just make us kill ourselves or each other? Or make our heads explode, Alice said. Her voice was trembling. I saw that in an old movie once. I don't know, Jordan said. He looked up at Clay. Where's the Raggedy Man? Is that what you call him? Clay looked down at his sketch, which he was still carrying. The torn flesh, the torn sleeve of the pullover, the baggy blue jeans. He supposed that Raggedy Man was not a bad name at all for the fellow in the Harvard hoodie. I call him Trouble, is what I call him, Jordan said in a thin voice. He looked out again at the newcomers. 300 at least, maybe 400, recently arrived from God knew which surrounding towns, and then back at Clay. Have you seen him? Other than in a bad dream, no. Tom shook his head. To me, he's just a picture on a piece of paper, Alice said. I didn't dream him, and I don't see anyone in a hoodie out there. What were they doing on the soccer field? Do they try to identify their dead, do you think? She looked doubtful at this. And isn't it still hot in there? It must be. What are they waiting for? Tom asked. If they aren't going to charge us or make us stick kitchen knives in each other, what are they waiting for? Clay suddenly knew what they were waiting for, and also where Jordan's Raggedy Man was. It was what Mr. Devane, his high school algebra teacher, would have called an aha moment. He turned and headed for the front hall. Where are you going? Tom asked. To see what they left us, Clay said. They hurried after him. Tom caught up first, while Clay's hand was still on the doorknob. I don't know if this is a good idea, he said. Maybe not, but it's what they're waiting for, Clay said. And you know what? I think if they meant to kill us, we'd be dead already. He's probably right, Jordan said in a small, wan voice. Clay opened the door. Cheatham Lodge's long front porch, with its comfortable wicker furniture and its view of Academy Slope rolling down to Academy Avenue, was made for sunny autumn afternoons like this. But at that moment, the ambiance was the furthest thing from Clay's mind. Standing at the foot of the steps was an arrowhead of phone crazies. One in front, two behind him, three behind them, then four, five, and six, 21 in all. The one in front was the Raggedy Man from Clay's dream, his sketch come to life. The lettering on the front of the tattered red hoodie did indeed spell out Harvard. The torn left cheek had been pulled up and secured at the side of the nose with two clumsy white stitches that had torn teardrops in the indifferently mended dark flesh before holding. There were rips where a third and fourth stitch had pulled free. Clay thought the stitching might have been done with fish line. The sagging lip revealed teeth that looked as if they had been seen to by a good orthodontist not long ago, when the world had been a milder place. In front of the door, burying the welcome mat and spreading in both directions, was a heap of black, misshapen objects. It could almost have been some half-mad sculptor's idea of art. It took Clay only a moment to realize he was looking at the melted remains of the Tunney Field flock's ghetto blasters. Then Alice shrieked. A few of the heat-warped boomboxes had fallen over when Clay opened the door, and something that had very likely been balanced on top of the pile had fallen over with them, lodging half in and half out of the pile. She stepped forward before Clay could stop her, dropping one of the automatic pistols and grabbing the thing she had seen. It was the sneaker. She cradled it between her breasts. Clay looked past her, at Tom. Tom gazed back at him. They weren't telepathic, but in that moment they might as well have been. Now what? Tom's eyes asked. Clay turned his attention back to the raggedy man. He wondered if you could feel your mind being read, and if his was being read right that second. He put his hands out to the raggedy man. The gun was still in one of them, but neither the raggedy man nor anyone in his squad seemed to feel threatened by it. Clay held his palms up. "What do you want?" The raggedy man smiled. There was no humor in the smile. Clay thought he could see anger in the dark brown eyes, but he thought it was a surface thing. Underneath, there was no spark at all, at least that he could discern. It was almost like watching a doll smile. The raggedy man cocked his head and held up a finger. "Wait." And from below them, on Academy Avenue, as if on cue, came many screams. Screams of people in mortal agony. Accompanying them were a few guttural, predatory cries. Not many.
"What are you doing?"
Alice shouted. She stepped forward, squeezing the little sneaker convulsively in her hand. The cords in her forearm stood out strongly enough to make shadows like long, straight pencil strokes on her skin.
"What are you doing to the people down there?"
As if, Clay thought, there could be any doubt. She raised the hand that still held a gun. Tom grabbed it and wrestled it away from her before she could pull the trigger. She turned on him, clawing at him with her free hand.
"Give it back! Don't you hear that? Don't you hear?"
Clay pulled her away from Tom. During all of this, Jordan watched from the entryway with wide, terrified eyes, and the raggedy man stood at the tip of the arrow, smiling from a face where rage underlay humor, and beneath the rage was nothing, as far as Clay could tell. Nothing at all. "Safety was on anyway," Tom said after a quick glance. "Thank the Lord for small favors." And to Alice, "Do you want to get us killed?"
"Do you think they're just going to let us go?"
She was crying so hard it had become difficult to understand her. Snot hung from her nostrils in two clear strings. From below, on the tree-lined avenue that ran past Gayton Academy, there were screams and shrieks. A woman cried, "No, please don't, please don't." And then her words were lost in a terrible howl of pain. "I don't know what they're going to do with us," Tom said in a voice that strove for calm. "But if they meant to kill us, they wouldn't be doing that. Look at him, Alice. What's going on down there is for our benefit." There were a few gunshots as people tried to defend themselves, but not many. Mostly there were just screams of pain and terrible surprise, all coming from the area directly adjacent to Gayton Academy, where the flock had been burned. It surely didn't last any longer than 10 minutes, but sometimes, Clay thought, time really was relative. It seemed like hours. Chapter 30. When the screams finally stopped, Alice stood quietly between Clay and Tom with her head lowered. She had put both automatics on a table meant for briefcases and hats inside the front door. Jordan was holding her hand, looking out at the raggedy man and his colleagues standing at the head of the walk. So far, the boy hadn't noticed the head's absence. Clay knew he would soon, and then the next scene of this terrible day would commence. The raggedy man took a step forward and made a little bow with his hands held out to either side, as if to say, "At your service." Then he looked up and held a hand out toward Academy Slope and the avenue beyond. He looked at the little group clustered in the open door behind the melted boombox sculpture as he did this. To Clay, the meaning seemed clear. "The road is yours. Go on and take it." "Maybe," he said. "In the meantime, let's be clear on one thing. I'm sure you can wipe us out if you choose to. You've obviously got the numbers. But unless you plan to hang back at Command HQ, someone else is going to be in charge of things tomorrow, because I'll personally make sure you're the first one to go." The raggedy man put his hands to his cheeks and widened his eyes. "Oh, dear." The others behind him were as expressionless as robots. Clay looked a moment longer, then gently closed the door.
"I'm sorry," Alice said dully. "I just couldn't stand listening to them scream."
"It's okay," Tom said. "No harm done. And hey, they brought back Mr. Sneaker." She looked at it.
"Is this how they found out it was us? Did they smell it the way a bloodhound smells a scent?"
"No," Jordan said. He was sitting in a high-backed chair beside the umbrella stand, looking small and haggard and used up. That's just their way of saying they know you. At least that's what I think.
Yeah, Clay said. I bet they knew it was us even before they got here. Picked it out of our dreams, the way we picked his face out of our dreams.
I didn't, Alice began.
Because you were waking up, Tom said. You'll be hearing from him in the fullness of time, I imagine. He paused. If he has anything else to say, that is.
I don't understand this, Clay. We did it. We did it, and they know we did it. I'm convinced of that.
Yes, Clay said.
Then why kill a bunch of innocent pilgrims when it would have been just as easy, well, almost as easy, to break in here and kill us? I mean, I understand the concept of reprisals, but I don't see the point in this.
That was when Jordan slid off his chair and, looking around with an expression of suddenly blossoming worry, asked,
"Where's the head?"
Chapter 31. Clay caught up with Jordan, but not until the boy had made it all the way to the second-floor landing.
"Hang on, Jordan," he said.
"No,"
Jordan said. His face was whiter, shockier than ever. His hair bushed out around his head, and Clay supposed it was only because the boy needed a cut, but it looked as if it were trying to stand on end.
"With all the commotion, he should have been with us. He would have been with us if he was all right."
His lips began to tremble.
"Remember the way he was rubbing himself? What if that wasn't just his acid reflux stuff?"
"Jordan."
Jordan paid no attention, and Clay was willing to bet he'd forgotten all about the Raggedy Man and his cohorts, at least for the time being. He yanked free of Clay's hand and went running down the corridor, yelling, "Sir! Sir!" while heads going back to the 19th century frowned down at him from walls. Clay glanced back down the stairs. Alice was going to be no help. She was sitting at the foot of the staircase with her head bent, staring at that fucking sneaker like it was the skull of Yorick. But Tom started reluctantly up to the second floor.
"How bad is this going to be?" he asked Clay.
"Well, Jordan thinks the head would have joined us if he was all right. And I tend to think he's..." Jordan began to shriek. It was a drilling soprano sound that went through Clay's head like a spear. It was actually Tom who got moving first. Clay was rooted at the staircase end of the corridor for at least 3 and perhaps as many as 7 seconds, held there by a single thought. That's not how someone sounds when they've found what looks like a heart attack. The old man must have botched it somehow. Maybe used the wrong kind of pills. He was halfway down the hall when Tom cried out in shock,
"Jordan, don't look!"
almost as if it were one word.
"Wait!"
Alice called from behind him, but Clay didn't. The door to the head's little upstairs suite was open. The study with its books and its now useless hot plate, the bedroom beyond with the door standing open so the light streamed through. Tom was standing in front of the desk, holding Jordan's head against his stomach. The head was seated behind his desk. His weight had rocked his swivel chair back on its pivot, and he seemed to be staring up at the ceiling with his one remaining eye. His tangled white hair hung down over the chair back. To Clay, he looked like a concert pianist who had just played the final chord of a difficult piece. He heard Alice give a choked cry of horror, but hardly noticed. Feeling like a passenger inside his own body, Clay walked to the desk and looked at the sheet of paper that rested on the blotter. Although it was stained with blood, he could make out the words on it. The head's cursive had been fine and clear. Old school to the end, Jordan might have said.
"Aliene, geisteskrank, insano, enlebajos, wasenig, fu, atomagokashi, gek, dolzenig, hulu, gila, meshuga, nebun, dement."
Clay spoke nothing but English and a little high school French, but he knew well enough what this was and what it meant. The Raggedy Man wanted them to go, and he knew somehow that Headmaster Ardai was too old and too arthritic to go with them, so he had been made to sit at his desk and write the word for insane in 14 different languages. And when he was done, he had been made to plunge the tip of his heavy fountain pen with which he had written into his right eye, and from there into the clever old brain behind it.
They made him kill himself, didn't they? Alice asked in a breaking voice. Why him and not us? Why him and not us? What do they want?
Clay thought of the gesture the Raggedy Man had made toward Academy Avenue. Academy Avenue, which was also New Hampshire Route 102. The phone crazies, who were no longer exactly crazy, or were crazy in some brand new way, wanted them on the road again. Beyond that, he had no idea, and maybe that was good. Maybe that was all for the best. Maybe that was a mercy.